This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net. Be honest, you judge books by their covers all of the time. I'll admit that I do anyway, and it's no wonder why. A book's cover is often the very first impression any one of us has long before we're able to open to the first page or read the back cover copy. So if you're worried about what your book's cover might look like, you're not alone. But worry no longer. This episode's guest is here to share her principles for book cover design and put you in a position to say, go ahead, judge away. Hey there, I'm International Book Awards finalist and RightsCast Network founder R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 94 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. This episode's guest is Carol Vandenhende. Carol Vandenhende is an author and American Fiction Awards winner who explores the visible and invisible challenges of imperfect heroes and heroines. She's also a public speaker who's presented at Writer's Digest, Women Who Write, Authorpreneur, Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, New Jersey Romance Writers, Rutgers, Liberty States Fiction Writers Conferences, and other events. Carol is active in her community as a climate reality leader, as a Board of Trustees volunteer officer for a special needs school, and by raising funds for nonprofits through the launch of her novel, Goodbye Orchid. I was really pleased to have the chance to interview Carol about book cover design, and I'm sure after having tuned in, you'll feel fantastic about your cover design prospects going forward. So let's get into it. It's time for my conversation with author Carol Vandenhende. Stay tuned afterward for more about what you can expect next from the RightsCast Network, and thanks, as always, for listening. Thank you so much, Carol Vandenhende, for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network.
Awesome, Ryan. I'm so glad to join you.
Yeah, we're going to be getting visual today. I know this is an audio medium, listeners, but we're going to be talking about book cover design. And it probably goes without saying or without needing to ask, but let's get this out of the way right away, Carol. Why is book cover design so important?
Well, you know, they always say, don't judge a book by its cover, but actually that is what people do. A huge part of our brains is taking in visual input from our world every day. And so we judge things quite quickly based on how they make us feel more than how they make us think, because so much of our decision-making is subconscious. So if we as authors are trying to reach our readers, then there is no better way than to spend some time and really encapsulate what is the unique differentiator for your book, your title, to the reader.
And I really like that you're touching on this idea of how a book makes us feel, because whether that is at the cover design process or during when a reader first looks at a book or even once they get into the pages, one thing that I think about often is that we can get so caught up in the words themselves that we miss out on what's important here, and that is that feeling. It's the imagery. It's how what it is that our reader takes away that lasts longer than memorizing any particular sentence or really cool turn of phrase. It's that striking image on the cover. It's how they felt as they read it, and it's how they feel when they first gaze at that cover. So points very well taken there. And Carol, obviously you have a big interest in book cover design, but what is it that first got you interested in book cover design?
Well, what's interesting about my background is before I became a published author with Goodbye Orchid, I was a marketer. And so I ran brands, major brands, you know, multi-million to billion dollar brands all around the world, in the US and in China. And in that work, it became really clear to me the importance and impact that design can have. It's also an area I absolutely love because it's beautiful. It just, you know, moves me emotionally as well. And then when I started in the writing world and started joining the writing community, there was a lot of pull for me to come into writers' conferences and speak and share my knowledge, because of course authors We go into it for the writing, but we don't realize we also have to be business people and marketers. And so people were asking for my expertise in this area. And as I looked into it, actually, book cover design is really interesting. There are so many titles that we're competing against, which is another reason why book cover design is important. And so for us to really break through, design is one of our most powerful tools to be able to do that. And I think that also book cover design has a lot of room for creativity. And I often say that when people don't really want to be marketers, they just want to be the writers, they just want to be authors, that sometimes it helps to think about marketing as an act of creativity as well. That you can get that sense of fulfillment and joy from marketing your book, as well as from the creativity of the writing.
And I really like that approach, because if we can embrace creativity at the heart of our marketing and at the heart of our publicity practices, you're right. It can feel like a refreshing thing rather than a daunting series of obstacles that are getting in our way. But part of that last response, you mentioned this idea of brand, how you had worked for these large brands. And that kind of brings me into my next question, because many, many moons ago, back in episode 6 of this show, we actually talked about establishing a brand as an author. And our guest for that episode, Cheryl Meir, talked about how brand is sort of the visual manifestation of who you are. And we talked about it specifically online, in social media, et cetera. But I understand, Carol, there is a difference between brand and visual identity. What is that difference for you?
Yeah, I think it's important to tease those two things apart and think about them separately. And it's actually the first place I start when I speak at writers' conferences, and people really find a lot of usefulness in this concept. And I'd simply define brand as a concept that encapsulates a unique positioning, differentiation, relevance, and meaning of a person, product, or service. And that's helpful because sometimes people, when they hear the word brand, they're thinking about, you know, their toothpaste or their iced tea, and they're like, wait a minute, what does that have to do with me? But it can apply to a person. It can be a personal brand. And if I had to use just one word to encapsulate that concept, I would say it's a promise. It's your promise to readers. What is it that you're going to deliver that is unique, that is in your voice? And so that as a concept is really useful to think about. And I often will do, that will be my foundational talk that I often do to teach people how to think about their personal brand, to go through the steps to really, articulate that first for yourself so that you can make sure you're being consistent against that. But then visual identity I see as the second step, which is then the visual manifestation of that brand promise in a visual world in which you would define, you know, what is that, you know, first of all, what's the objective that you're trying to achieve in that visual world based on the promise that you're giving to readers? But also then you'd be translating that into a color palette, into what are the elements that should exist and shouldn't in order to achieve that emotive or emotional response that we talked about right at the top of the interview.
And one of the words that stood out to me there was consistent or consistency. And I know that we're going to talk a fair amount about that word going forward here, but I'm sure it'll figure into this next question as well, which is this idea of translating now our understanding of brand and visual identity specifically into the realm of book cover design. Because you mentioned things like color palettes in that in your previous response, and I'm sure that we're going to get into that here. So why don't we then? What role, Carol, do brand and visual identity play in book cover design?
I mean, ultimately, what you're ultimately striving for is that you as the author, in partnership with your design, your designer or your designers, your team, are thinking about the brand and the visual identity, and that's how you're strategically driving what should be on the cover. But for a reader, you don't want the reader to have to see all that hard work. I mean, this is the way our writing is too, right? Where the reader just experiences it, has that emotive response, is drawn to it because it's creating that emotional resonance that you're striving for. But you don't want that, the work to show through. So I often say that's the same with our writing, in that when you read a wonderful book, you fall into it and you're lost in it, and it feels so easy to read. And that's why sometimes readers think, oh, well, I can just go write a book too because it's so easy to read it that it must be easy to write it. And that's not the case. And that's, I make that analogy for authors because it's the same with design. It takes thought and work. I mean, it's joyful work. I actually love this work. So I almost hate to use the word work to apply to it. But the reader won't see all that, the thought and the, you know, exploration and the different avenues you explored to get to the final product. Hopefully they'll just have, you know, the joy and the emotions that you're striving for when they see the cover. But yeah.
And I love that you're talking about how a reader goes to our book and they say it's easy to read, so it must be easy to write a book. That's something that I could do. And in the same way, though, that we as authors maybe do, of course we want our books to be easy to read, we also should want, and this is that synergy here, our covers to have, perhaps we'll use a word like message, we want that message, we want those feelings to be easy to discern, which is why something like consistency, as we'll get into again shortly here, seems really important. We need some sort of cohesiveness or coherence to the design, and I'm sure that that's a big part of what brand and visual identity play in cover design as well.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the concepts I talk about is writing a really single-minded brief, because it is so important to get down to what do you want to communicate? What are the most, you know, salient points, and that it's not everything under the sun. I think sometimes, you know, mistakes I see that authors might make if they don't have a lot of experience in design is either, you know, what you're describing, which is they think, well, beautiful covers look so simple that they think it must be easy to design them, and that's actually not the case. Or the other mistake is to try to put too much into there, that they're thinking that it needs to encapsulate the entire, you know, arc of their story, every sub character and subplot. And, you know, honestly, that's, you know, what you really need to do is capture the central tension or hook, or what is the reason that a reader would want to pick up the book and learn more. Because really, the cover is to capture enough attention that somebody wants to learn more about that title. I'm holding Goodbye Orchid in my hands right now as an example. And, you know, just thinking about the ways in which I, you know, applied all of these concepts to briefing the designer, thinking about what was most important to communicate, and, you know, ultimately ending up with this cover that is very strong, both because of the visual contrast of, you know, the dark background and then the white title, as well as the image of the shattering orchids, which is so central to the tension of the story because of the emotional and physical shattering of the protagonists that the story is about.
And we're talking, of course, now about this in the context of your novel, Goodbye Orchid, and how it is that you arrived at the final cover for that book. And I'm sure that all of that is going to tie into these five best practices for book cover design. And listeners, I keep mentioning consistency because I know that that is the first of our five. But Carol, why don't you go ahead and list all five of these best practices before we cover each one of them a bit more in depth?
Absolutely. So the five best practices that I teach on book cover design is, number one, visual consistency. Number two, this idea of a single-minded brief. Number three, how to be a great collaborator with your designer or designers. Number four, the ability to achieve both breakthrough and meaning. And I know we're going to have time to define those. And then number five, assessing your design in context.
So a lot to unpack there, because all of that just seems like it is just rife with a great deal of depth. And as I mentioned, listeners, we are going to cover all five of those over the course of this conversation. So why don't we get right into this very first principle, this very first best practice, and that one is consistency. So Carol, what is it that you mean by consistency, and then how does that manifest in the lead up to and during the cover design process, even specifically in the context of Goodbye Orchid?
Yeah. So what I mean by consistency is the use of visual elements in a consistent way so that readers can learn to associate those with your book and with your author brand, so that those can break through and that readers can find you time and again. You know, the why that's so important is because actually, as human beings, we are bombarded with lots of messages every day. There are some studies that show that we're faced with 5,000 messages a day. And, you know, so to even navigate a world that is so full of visual stimulus and messaging and headlines and news and all types of things, people tend to come up, you know, and it's not conscious, it's happening at the subconscious level. People tend to come up with ways to make decision-making easier. So that's why oftentimes a lot of people actually have the same breakfast every morning, because it takes out a decision out of your life. You know, in the morning, you don't have to be, you know, scanning your pantry. You can just turn to your oatmeal and have that, because there's so many decisions to be made a day. And so if we as authors are trying to reach readers and want them to decide to pick up our book, to learn more about it, we actually need to employ everything we can to try to capture a bit of that attention, because attention is finite and there are so many things pulling at our attention. It's not only, sometimes as an author, we get so focused on our book that we only think about that, and we think since our attention is there, that everyone's attention must be there. But actually, people's attentions are split between family and kids and work and so many things happening in the world, of course. And so, design is a great way, and the consistency of that design to be able to break through. You can see really good examples of this in the big brands of the world. And so you might ask yourself, why has a brand like Tiffany used that same robin's egg blue consistently over decades, over the life of its brand? Or, you know, you can name any big brand that you buy or use on a daily basis. The consistency with which they represent their trademark is remarkable. Over, you know, some of them over a century, the same, and it's not just, you know, Coca-Cola red, some, you know, random shade of red, and sometimes it's scarlet and sometimes it's plum. It is always the exact same hue. And that is because people actually process shapes and colors before they read letters or numbers. And so the importance of having that consistency is so that you can break through and people will be able to find you. That that Tiffany blue, when you see it, you know, almost first at a subconscious level, in a split second, you recognize that, and all of the memories that you have stored about Tiffany, you know, very premium, luxury, maybe unaffordable, beautiful, elegant, you know, those all come, you know, streaming back, not in a, you know, literal way, but in this, like, the feeling of the brand comes back. And that's what you're striving to do. And actually, there's also studies that show it takes 2 to 7 times for something to break through. And so you actually need to have that same visual identity consistently shown multiple times for them to maybe even notice it for the first time. The time that a reader thinks they've seen your title for the first time might be the 7th time they've been exposed to it.
Halloween cometh, as does National Novel Writing Month, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company is preparing for the merriment and, well, the misery that accompanies the forthcoming holiday season. Are you struggling with writer's block as the year comes to an end? Burn it away with Kill Your Darlings Candle Company's new candle by that very name. Yes, their writer's block candle is a proprietary blend of spiced honey and whiskey, and it's a must burn whenever you're desperate for your words to burn through you. And then there's Diverged in a Wood, an homage to the Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. Diverged in a Wood smells of fir, spruce, and cedar, or, in other words, it's the perfect candle to introduce some solace to your writing and reading regimen or to complement your seasonal soirees. So visit kydcandleco.com today to get your writer's block, Diverged in a Wood, or candles from their signature selection. Again, that's kydcandleco.com. Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. Candles for the wordsmiths of the world. And I'll say in there was, first of all, some very relatable content in the form of people choosing to eat the same thing for breakfast every day. My wife will make fun of me for that till the, you know, the cows come home, so to speak. But I will cling to my English muffins with peanut butter till I die. Anyway, but on your point about keeping things, you know, consistent, I have to imagine that this is not just about, of course, with one's book cover and where it appears. This is also, we're talking cross-platform stuff, because in your example of Coca-Cola, well, we know what that Coca-Cola red looks like. We see it on the can. And if you go to the Coca-Cola website, I don't have it pulled up now, but I am sure, well, what are some of the first colors you're going to see, or what's the dominant color on the screen? It's probably that Coca-Cola red. So I would imagine, Carol, that in the same way that a brand like Coca-Cola is doing this, once we have our book cover and we know that we're going to be gearing up for a big time book launch, well, what do we want to do? Well, we probably want our website to be bringing in those same colors, to be bringing in that same visual identity. We want it there. We want it on our social media platforms. We want it in our newsletters that go out. Because like you say, if it's going to take 7 times for someone to finally go, oh, yes, that's what that is, I really recognize it now, don't we want to make that 7th time come earlier than later?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what you'll find, you know, if you go to my website, what everything you say is 100% true. If you go to any of my social media, the color palette for Goodbye Orchid, it's really deep purple in the background. It has the white lettering and then the image of kind of purpley shattered orchids. And those are in, you know, my social media headers, in my on my website. But actually for me, my website came before my book. And so I had defined my author brand and that promise first, and the visual world for that brand. And then when I briefed for the book cover, I had the book cover live in that world so that they weren't inconsistent.
And that seems like a really incredible approach, because if you're going to, for example, try to establish this brand as an author, if you're going to establish a visual identity as an author, and you're someone who is going to have multiple books out over time, well, wouldn't it be wonderful if every time you had a new book coming out, you didn't have to completely upend your site or create an entirely new visual identity? You could just kind of keep things in this similar world. I would think that that would be really reassuring, and it certainly cuts down on what needs to be done to tune up one's website all the time.
Yes,
but
yes.
I like, Carol, that you're talking about this idea of brief, right? You mentioned it earlier in the conversation and within the last minute here, and I know that that is the second of these 5 practices for book cover design. So what is it really that you mean by brief, or by writing a brief, and how is it that we can keep this in mind? How is it that we can make that work for us?
Yeah, and I'm using terminology from a professional marketer standpoint. When we work with design agencies, there is always a brief. And the brief is simply a document that captures, you know, the key elements that are important to share with a designer. And I think there's, and so when you, depending on the designer you work with, they may have a different process and they may call it something else. My publisher calls my brief an author questionnaire, which is fine. Whatever they call it, it's fine. It's a place to capture what's important to communicate. And I think there's a few places that are important to call out that might not be immediately obvious when it comes to the brief. Because I'd say 2 things. One, sometimes people want to put everything about their book in that brief, because of course we love our work. And, you know, my book is 67,000 words long, but what I need to do is to, you know, really condense that 67,000 words into what is the single, you know, moment that I need to capture that is most important to communicate, so that the brief is single-minded. It took 67,000 words to tell the story of Goodbye Orchid. I can't put 67,000 words in the brief, and I can't ask for all different things that can be conflicting, because that causes a cover to be overloaded with too many different things.
With the idea of single-mindedness in mind, that's actually really important, because I can say from my own experience providing what was, you know, also referred to as an author questionnaire to my publisher to be passed along to the cover designer. When I did that for my first book, you know, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. I had a book, and I believe that that title is about 90,000 words. I had so many different motifs, and I wanted to really lay out something that would be, in my view, easy for this book cover designer to look at and say, okay, here I have a lot to choose from, right? It's going to make it easier on them if I just give them as much as I can, and we're just going to pour it all onto the page. Well, what happened? Because I didn't have this concise, we could call it even a brief, tidy message for the brief itself, the first cover that came back to me for, you know, checking out before we got to the collaboration stage was horrifying. And I say this not as a slight against the book cover designer, who is immensely talented. I mean, the work that she does for the publisher that I am with is just spectacular. And so when I saw this, I went, well, something happened here. And that something, it turns out, was me, because I didn't have this sort of single-mindedness. I didn't have my brief coalescing around an image or around a particular, you know, subset of imagery that could really drive home what it is that I wanted to be the takeaway from this book. I just kind of exploded and I let it all be thrown onto the page in the hopes that it would come together for me. And we got a challenging result. And it wasn't until I pared it back and said, okay, look, I'm giving you too much information. Ignore 80% of this stuff and let's give it another shot. It was then that it really started to come together and lesson learned. So folks, you can learn from my mistake and from the fact that Carol has now told you in advance how this stuff works to not do what I did.
That is such good self-reflection that you realize that that's the problem. My day job now, so I'd spent 15 years as a marketer, but now I'm a strategist. And strategy is about making choices. And so this concept really resonates with me. And I love that you had that experience where in real life, it made a difference when you really narrowed down what was important. Go ahead. Do you want
to? Oh, no. Please continue.
I was just going to say, I remembered my second point that I lost earlier.
Oh, please,
earlier
then let's do it. Let's make it happen.
Yeah. So I think the other thing, and you tell me if you had this experience when you briefed your designer, is I always think about this as the creative process. Of course, it's a delicate process. It's also a very emotional process. I always want to inspire my designers with my brief, that's actually how you get great work from designers. It's not about the designer themselves. It is so much on the client. It is absolutely, you know, maybe 50-50. I don't even know how to quantify that. But I actually really try to inspire the designer with, you know, what is it? What was my hope in writing this book? You know, what good can it do in the world? How can it help readers? You know, I talk about my personal why as inspiring hope and empathy for people and planet. And that's what definitely the inspiring hope and empathy for people is woven throughout every page of Goodbye Orchid. And so I let the designer know that, you know, that I have this higher order purpose, that it's, you know, meant to help people in the world, and this is how. And that inspiration, I think, inspires better work too. It's not a transactional thing. And we'll talk about that when we get to point three around collaboration.
This episode is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps writers and authors thrive online. If you need to get your writer's platform up and running fast, Dandelion Web Marketing's Author Quick Start packages are the place to start. These Author Quick Start packages take the headache out of creating your author website and can help you with that all-important analytics tracking and more. So become your best you online today with Dandelion Web Marketing by visiting dandelionwebmarketing.com/writers to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/writers. Well, and what I like what you're saying there is, well, first and foremost, I will say at the time that I was submitting the author questionnaire for that first book and even for the books that followed, because they came in such rapid succession, I didn't have an opportunity to have completely decompressed and figured out that what's really important to communicate in those briefs is some of what you've touched on. It's trying to answer these questions of who you are, what you write, and why you write it. And can you find a way to use the answers to those questions to inspire the book cover designer to meet you where you're at, not by necessarily, I mean, you're conveying it with your words, of course, but by trying to, again, center it around this feeling that we mentioned at the top of the episode. What's the feeling meant to be? And can we inspire it such that the individual who's going to be creating the book cover, they can feel their way toward it. They can actually go through the experience of reading the book, perhaps without reading it, such that they go, oh, yeah, I totally get it. And now I can go ahead and make this work for this author. Because all of this is making me think actually about an episode that was released earlier this year. And that was with Lori Buchanan on the business of being an author. And we talked about what it means to you know, have a mission statement, to have a vision statement for a brand or for a business, but also to think about who we are as authors and what we want. What's our vision for ourselves? And if that is a vision that's going to underlie the themes in our work and the imagery, the motifs that we incorporate, if that's uniform enough and we can create an experience around those things and convey that experience in the brief, well, then our book cover designer, they're in a great place to be inspired and to make this happen for us. So, regrettably, I didn't learn any of that until a little late in the game, but you know, there are more books to come. And so there are things to look forward to in that regard. But that was my experience with all of that anyway.
It's great to hear that you've, you know, you can back up these points with your own personal experience.
Yes, it is. I always have to provide that contrast. You know, it's important to give the example, because I think sometimes we can, in conversations like these, it can feel as though we are here, we're providing information, but people need that context, right? And I'm more than happy to be the example of what not to do, because we're all learning, you know, we're all just out there trying our best. And the important thing to remember here too, as you have hinted at, is that this is going to be a collaborative process. I mean, collaboration is a big component of success at every stage of one's writing journey, but I know that it plays an especially important role in the realm of book cover design. So Carol, why don't you touch on collaboration as the third of our five best practices for book cover design?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's so important to be a collaborative partner with your designer, not to think that it's their sole job, but actually you are right there as a co-pilot in the work. And a lot of the collaboration comes in the form of, first, we talked about the brief, but then once you get a first set of designs, the way in which you assess the design, the way in which you provide feedback is really important. And so it might not be immediately obvious if you haven't been through a design process, because oftentimes I'll see people, when they get designs, they're just talking about what they like or they don't like. But actually, it's not about personal taste, because in the end, remember, the objective is to reach the reader. And what message can you land with the reader? And so you've done all the work in the thinking behind the brief. You've created the single-minded brief. You've really thought about what that key point is. So the most important thing is, first, assess against the brief, not against your personal taste. That, you know, what you're assessing is it meeting the single-minded objective that you put into the brief? And then you give the feedback in that way. I don't say things like, I like this or I don't like that. I say, you know, does this achieve the objective of capturing the emotional and physical shattering of Phoenix and Orchid in Goodbye Orchid, for example? And then the other things sometimes that I see people making a mistake about is the early rounds of design can be rough. And that's fine, because if you're exploring multiple routes, then all you want to do is get a sense which of the routes is the most productive to pursue. And so I actually like exploring multiple routes that can achieve the same objective before narrowing down. It's actually a concept in design thinking too, which we can get to later if you want to. But I think that that's sometimes the early rounds is where authors might make the mistake of giving very fine-tuned feedback, like, oh, that picture's a little blurry, or that shade of yellow's a little too bright. That's not the type of feedback that's helpful in the early rounds. It's more about what is overall achieving the objective best. And then once you've narrowed down to a design route or two, then you can focus on how to fine-tune those to really get to the ultimate product. And then this is also, lastly, I would just say, when it comes to assessing and collaborating with the designer, is to think about the elements that are going to be consistent long-term. Because if you're not just putting this one book out, oftentimes we're writing in series or we're writing multiple books, to think about the parts of the design that are going to stay consistent in order to have readers be able to find you time and again. And the one I'd call out most is your author name, the way your author name is represented, because that is typically the thing that is consistent title to title. And that's important because you want people to come back, if they've loved your first book, that they will come back and find you for your second book and your third and your fourth, et cetera. And so it is important to give some thought to how your author name is represented.
You know, Carol, I got to say, where were you when I was going through the cover design process? Because this has just been, it's really elucidating to even think about it in the context of understanding that of course, a first pass in most cases at a cover isn't going to be precisely what it is that maybe the author had in mind, because it's about this idea of convergence and then really clarifying for us. And I'll say, you know, me specifically here, that in those first rounds of feedback, it isn't about whether the yellow is too bright or something's too blurry or not blurry enough. Just it all clicks when you hear it out loud. But when you're going through the process and you're very excited and you're very emotional about your book, it's really easy to lose track of these sorts of things. So I got to say, that's really hitting home for me. And it's something that now I'm like, oh, I got to get some of my manuscripts back out in the world. I got to go through this process again. I'm feeling real good about it. And I like, too, that you have this idea of making sure your author name is represented the same across all of your titles. And that's actually a question that I have got in the past at conferences when I'm speaking, is people will see on that opening slide and then again at the end slide, they say, okay, so you've told us to call you Ryan. And I'm like, yes, you can call me Ryan. RR is hard to pronounce and it makes you sound like a pirate. And they say, okay, that's fine. But why do you do RR Campbell in all lowercase letters? And my original response to that was, I don't know. I just kind of felt like the capital R's and the capital C all in a row. Well, it felt like someone was screaming at you. But then also I thought, well, I don't know. I think all the lowercase stuff kind of complements the work more. And if I keep it consistent, it does stand out. And so, hey, there's a point in the column of things that I didn't botch on the first go around. So I'll give myself a little credit there.
I do. I like your RR. I like that it's all lowercase. It's more familiar. It feels like approachable. It feels like a friend.
It's like, I'm trying to step forward with my head like bowed a little bit, just trying to be like, hey, it's gonna be okay. I don't want to come forward with these big capital R's and my shoulders squared. That's not who I am as a person, you know?
Right. So. It's quite humble. It's lovely.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm glad it's connecting. That's great. I will say that, of course, you know, we're talking a little bit maybe about the meaning behind these things and how maybe it might seem silly at first glance that two lowercase r's would compare to two uppercase r's and add this extra shade of meaning. But breakthrough and meaning play critical roles in cover design. They are, of course, the fourth best practice out of our five here. So why don't we go ahead here, Carol, and define what's meant by breakthrough in meaning, and then what does all of this mean in context?
Yeah, I mean, this is really important because, and I put these two together, breakthrough and meaning, because they can be in, this is where sometimes you feel like you're making trade-offs or they can be in tension with each other. And that's the magic of a cover that works, is it needs to be able to achieve both. So what we mean by breakthrough is the ability to be eye-catching, that somebody will notice you. And actually, we're going to talk about when we get to in context, but there are some really busy places that books show up. And so for it to break through, for a reader to even notice, to be able to pick up the book and learn a little bit more, is what we're oftentimes striving for. But we don't want to do that at the expense of losing meaning. And what I mean by meaning is simply the ability to communicate that idea that was in the single-minded brief, and really, you know, capturing what is the book about. And so let me give an example, because, and I show this in conferences, you know, you could try to land breakthrough by screaming at the reader, almost your description of your name. You know, if you did the capital R, capital R, capital C, that you might, maybe, I don't know, maybe you could achieve more breakthrough that way because, you know, it's louder, but then that doesn't fit with the meaning of Ryan, who is, you know, not coming, you know, broad-shouldered and all blustery, you know. And so one of the examples I share is, it's quite well known in the world of marketing and in promotions that red and yellow together, yellow and red together, are very strong breakthrough colors. You know, sometimes you'll see them to like, you know, scream some kind of 99-cent price promotion or, you know, in a store. But the question I ask is, does that mean that your book cover should be all red and yellow to achieve breakthrough? And some book covers are red and yellow, and if it fits the meaning, then that's fine. But if your meaning isn't that, then that isn't the route to go. Then you need to be able to choose both. You need to be able to find a way to get the noticeability and have the, you know, really the heart of the book come through as well.
Is it fair to say then, Carol, that we might frame it then as sort of using meaning to drive breakthrough, or at least to drive how that breakthrough manifests?
Yes. I mean, there's two levels to the meaning and the breakthrough. One is the, like, what's the concept of what you're trying to communicate? But then the second is, what does that mean in visual language? You know, and this is why sometimes designers will use contrast of colors to try to get the breakthrough, even if they're using a more subdued color palette to be able to convey the meaning. And this actually reminds me of another point when you're working with designers, that as you're getting the designs and you're giving feedback, your feedback should be about, you know, the ways in which the design is or is not achieving the brief, is or is not achieving breakthrough and meaning in your perspective. And remember that your opinion is only one of this, you know, in this collaborative relationship. But it actually is not that helpful for the feedback to be tactical. And so what I mean by that is, it's not so helpful to say, well, I think that, you know, diamond on the cover is too high up, it needs to be lower. Because that's telling the designer their job, and actually they're the experts. And so they're the ones that should know how to achieve the objective. So rather it could be, what's more helpful feedback, instead of saying move the diamond lower, is saying, well, you know, in our communications hierarchy, which is a concept I'll define in a moment, we talked about, you know, seeing the title first and then the key image of the diamond second and my author name third, but actually where the diamond is, I'm seeing it first. And so that gives the why to the designer, and then the designer can come up with different ways to solve for the why, solve for what the issue is that you're finding. And they may come up with ideas that you didn't even think of. Your own, you know, as a reader and as a, you know, somebody who's not a design professional, you might only think of the one way to move it down lower. But they're actually, you know, and some designers will, trying to please the client, just do exactly what you say. But you will have missed the opportunity to find the other routes that could have been there. And I'm sorry, I introduced this idea of communications hierarchy and hadn't defined it. So hopefully it's self-evident, but it's quite simply in the brief, being able to tell the designer, you know, where should the eye go for second and third? And I would say there should be no more than two or three. There shouldn't be like, oh, and this is where your eye should go fourth and fifth and sixth, you know, because again, this idea of being single-minded. And oftentimes it is those three things you're playing with, you know. So for a really famous author, James Patterson, Harlan Coben, you know, maybe their design brief says author name should be number one. As a debut author, I would say I did not put my author name as the first thing that needed to be communicated.
So we're talking book cover design in this episode, right? Well, once you have an amazing book cover made for your book, you're going to need equally incredible photos of your book to help promote it online. And that is where, friends, that is where Mockup Shots come in. Mockup Shots is an online software brought to you by Adazing that lets you upload your book cover to create high-quality images of your books for marketing and publicity purposes. Using Mockup Shots has helped me further develop my brand and sharpened my web presence, whether it be on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or on my author site. Not only that, but Mockup Shots has saved me tons of time. Whenever I need a stunning new photo of one of my books, I can simply hop into Mockup Shots, upload my book cover, and generate a beautiful photo of my book in minutes. Sound awesome? It is. And if you head to bit.ly/coverphotosdeal now, you can get Mockup Shots at a special RightsCast Network discount. Yes, so head to bit.ly/coverphotosdeal today and start making your book and its cover shine online. And I think that that kind of ties us into, or brings us into, this idea of doing an assessment in context, right? Because we're thinking about this, in my understanding anyway, at this stage, we're talking not necessarily only about the context in which people will see our cover, but also the context on the cover itself. Am I kind of understanding that correctly? It's not just about where our cover is and how it fits into perhaps where it appears on our website or what it looks like when it's on a bookshelf. We're talking about these physical components to the cover, including things like our author name and our title. Is that kind of leading us in the right direction here?
So when I talk about that fifth principle, I'm actually just talking about where it lives in the world. But I do think you're right in terms of this idea of context can apply to the elements of the cover design itself, that they are living in context with each other. And you talked about this idea of a cohesive design up front, and I think you're absolutely right. That's what you're aiming for. The thing as a whole should give a feeling that is enough to have somebody pick it up and read at least the blurb and learn a little bit more, and then hopefully ultimately convert to sales. But yeah, so I think you're right. You're onto something there. But I would say when I talk about this fifth area of assessing design in context, I am talking about in situ. I'm talking about, you know, imagining where it's going to live. In a bookstore, I mean, if we're very lucky, we might get a physical display where the cover is face out. But oftentimes, it's actually spine only.
Mm-hmm.
And so we spend a lot of our time when we get designs focused on the front. And, you know, that can be flawed, actually. You should be spending as much time on the spine of the book, actually, and making sure it's clear, it's legible, and it's able to communicate in that tiny little space. And in fact, the other place that it's really important to assess design is in context with other titles where you're going to show up in online places like Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Bookshop and other places, because those are tiny thumbnails. And so sometimes when we get a design from our designers, we have it all blown up on our screen, it's oversized, and we fall in love and we pay a lot of attention. You know, we're nitpicking with the designer about tiny little things that really don't matter, because in the end, a lot of times people are only seeing a 1-inch high version of the title of the book cover. And therefore, you just need to be able to register enough that it seems interesting, that the title is mostly legible, to be able to have somebody to click through.
To click through, or as you've mentioned, with the idea of the spine needing to stand out as well, thinking about, okay, I don't know, maybe this is as, maybe people get this granular, but between what other authors might this book be pinched and what color schemes are they working with? If we have a pinkish spine, is it going to stand out against maybe some of the other darker covers in the area? Is that in line with our original meaning that we want to convey? How can we break through? The questions kind of follow us all the way down. But as you mentioned, if our brief is clear and it is communicating this idea of the single-mindedness, you know, what is our purpose? And we can always go back to that brief to check everything against that brief. Well, it seems like for all the rest of these five best practices that we're setting ourselves up for success or for a better shot at success, because, well, we'll know how it's going to be assessed in context if it's going to tie back into that brief. It's sort of a, how do we define success for this book cover? And can we say mission accomplished when we get to the end, sort of thing?
You just summarized it beautifully. You really did bring all, you know, really all five principles work together.
They work together in the same way that we're going to see our cover, the imagery that is on it, the title of the book, and our author name. They all exist in a context too. They have to work together on the front of the book, on the spine of the book, wherever it is. So cool. Well, I'm leaving this conversation with a really incredible understanding and a more nuanced understanding of what it takes to put a quality cover together and what it is that is required of us as authors to be good partners in that process. So I am really grateful for this conversation, Carol. I can't thank you enough for elucidating all of this for me and for listeners. But before we draw this conversation to a close, I kind of want to talk more about you here for a minute. Where is it that listeners can find you online? Where can they learn more about Goodbye Orchid? And can you share just a little bit more with us about that book?
Absolutely. So listeners can find me on my website at carolvandenhenda.com, or maybe a simpler place, which has all the links to my socials as well as my website, is Linktree. So linktr.ee/cvdh. And you'll see on there, you know, links to my Goodreads, et cetera. And thank you for asking about my project, because Goodbye Orchid is absolutely a project of my heart. It is inspired by combat wounded veterans who, you know, go to fight for our freedom at the top of their game and come back wounded. And, you know, what really inspired me about them is the strength and resilience that they get back to good with. And so the characters in Goodbye Orchid, they're not military characters. They're actually set in a world I know quite well. Phoenix Walker is an entrepreneur, very successful. He's created his own advertising agency. And he has everything going for him, including falling in love with beautiful half-Asian Orchid Page and hashtag own voices. You guys are listening to audio, so you don't know that I'm Chinese-American. And the two of them are just, you know, completely haven't fallen in love with each other head over heels until when she leaves on a 6-week business trip to overseas, actually to China, an accident befalls Phoenix. And when he wakes in the hospital, thinking about Orchid, longing for her, he finds he's forever changed. And what he knows about Orchid's background is that she's had trauma in her past. She's had a traumatic childhood and actually is really sensitive to images of trauma. And now that he's an image of trauma himself, he's faced with the hardest decision of his life, whether to love her, he might need to leave her. And what you'll see if you look at, you know, kind of the back cover, it says rising from ashes is hard. Giving up the one you love is harder. And this is why Phoenix is named Phoenix, you know, that phoenixes in mythology have to rise from ashes. And this is exactly the hero's journey that Phoenix goes through and Orchid goes through as well. Her growth is incredible, as well as Caleb, who is Phoenix's twin brother.
Sounds like some really compelling stuff there, Carol. So I'm glad that you took a moment there to share that with listeners as we wind this conversation down. So listeners, again, this is Carol Vandenhende. The book is Goodbye Orchid. You know where you can find her online, and please go out, seek her out, check out her book. And Carol, I want to thank you again for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell Rightscast here on the Rightscast Network.
You're welcome. I've so loved it. And I just realized one more thing, which is there's a design detail, an Easter egg design detail hidden inside every physical copy of Goodbye Orchid. So you should get a physical copy so that you can flip through the pages in which there's an image of an orchid on the bottom lower corner of every page, and you will see the orchids appear to shatter and reform, which is another way to bring the idea to life in design.
Now that is thinking ahead. That is really embracing design. So thank you for that as well, because that's a good image to leave us with here.
Awesome. Thanks, Ryan.
And so concludes my interview of Carol Vandenhende, author of Goodbye Orchid. Thank you, Carol, for joining us for this episode. And thanks to you, dear listeners, for the same. I'd also like to thank the Rightscast Network's patrons, including Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley, who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks as well to our on-air sponsors Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. To learn more about them or our other sponsors, you can visit rightscast.net/sponsors. We're also grateful for audio support from Electronauts, Inc. To learn more about their audio production and maintenance services, visit electronautsinc.com. That's electronautsinc.com. Coming up next on the Rightscast Network is an episode of Biblio Breakdown featuring Ekta Garg. So stay tuned for that episode, which will debut on rightscast.net, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts on October 30th. In the meantime, you can say hello on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Rightscast, or by searching for the Rightscast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com. To reach me personally, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com or holler at me on Twitter as I am R.R. Campbell. I love hearing from listeners of all backgrounds, so please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well. This is the Rightscast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net.